You're listening to The Clear Spot on Resonance 104.4 FM, and tonight's show is an episode of the Six Weekly Show about publishing, Booklist. I'm Alex Fitch, and tonight I'm talking to three generations of illustrators. David McKee, creator of Mr. Ben, King Rollo and Elmer the Patchwork Elephant. Dave McKean, artist of young adult books by David Almond, graphic novels and picture books by Neil Gaiman, and Richard Dawkins' first science book for children, The Magic of Reality. And also Jim Kay, illustrator of Patrick Ness's book, A Monster Calls, and Toby Fallwood's Flaxfield Quartet of novels about dragons. The show also includes an extract from Dave McKean's presentation of his work, From the Magic of Reality, at the book's launch in Foyles in September last year. First, here's my interview with David McKee. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to David McKee at the Illustration Cupboard in Mayfair. The exhibition that we're at, that you've just spent the last 2 hours signing books at and meeting your fans.
All day signing books.
Is celebrating the 40th anniversary of Mr. Ben. And although you've created other children's characters over the years, such as King Rollo and Elmer the Elephant, this seems to be the one character of yours that seems to have had the real kind of lasting success for various generations. Did you have any idea when you first created Mr. Ben 40 years ago that two generations on, parents and children would still be enjoying it?
Well, the first thing is it's 40 years of the first transmission of Mr. Ben. And the book, first book came out in 67. So I'd have done that a year before, so it's from about 66, I guess. So it goes back a bit. No, I had no idea. I mean, I still don't have any idea. I can't really relate to that time bit. And what it has is a special cult sort of following, which is it's quite fascinating for me as well. It's him that's... it's not like it's me, it's like it's him, you know.
Well, I'd like to think it's the combination of the two, the character and your way of drawing him.
But Elmer also, on a worldwide basis, is very... is highly followed as well. It's probably... and it earns me more than Mr. Ben does, yeah. Mr. Ben doesn't actually earn me a lot of money, but it's... But it gets me a lot of people saying, "Oh, you did Mr. Ben. I love that." You know, and that's fantastic. You know, yeah.
It's been discussed before how the look of the character was influenced by a photo that you saw, and the name of the street he lives on is named after a street that you lived on. But the idea of a character who, by taking on different costumes, also enters different genres of adventures. Where did that original idea generate?
Well, it came the reverse way round. That I wrote... I wanted to do a book... I was drawing cartoons at the time. I drew... that's how I was earning my money. And that's how I first earned my money when I left college. I was drawing quite a few knights in armour, and I wanted to do a book about a knight in armour. So the story of the knight in armour was formed before the head and tail of Mr. Ben came into it. And I didn't realise I had a series. You know, I took the book in, the publisher liked it and all the rest of it, and then somebody in the publisher's office said, "Well, what's he going to try on next time?" And I said, "Nothing." Just looked at him, and he said, "Well, obviously he's going to go back to the costume shop." And then I thought, well, yes, he can go back to the costume shop. And the second one was the book, The Prisoner, where it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, Ben. And but we didn't make a film with that. That was considered to be not a topic which was going to be suitable for a Watch for Mother slot. So, how long things... I don't think you do think about how long things are going to go on. In one way, you assume they will always be there once they've been done. And in another way, all you're thinking about is the next thing you're working on. You know, the stuff's in your head, you have to get it out. And it's in the paper, and you've got to make it come... get that one of those images out when you think of all that stuff that's in the paper.
And I suppose once you knew that you had a kind of storytelling device that would let you tell a story that was a Western or science fiction or fantasy, that must have been very appealing, because it meant you could tell any kind of story you liked.
And then, in fact, it was the kind of stories that I liked that I wanted to write. I was not brought up in a book background. I was brought up in a storytelling background. And really, it was the books which became important for me. Films came later. You know.
Yeah.
So we didn't have, when my kids were young, we didn't have television until the third one was born, I think. And then I watched the Watch for Mother slot. And so when the BBC said, you know, are you interested in doing it? That's when doing a series for Watch for Mother. I went with a different series based around a fort, but life inside the fort. No battles or anything, just parades, the washing, and the women who were in charge behind the scenes of their husbands who went out and paraded, and the band and all the rest of it. But we didn't. But they didn't like that idea, and I talked about Mr. Ben, and they immediately went for that as an idea. Yeah.
Did you find animation a medium quite easy to move into from having done illustration?
I didn't know. I'd never made film. I didn't know anything about it. The BBC gave me the money to make a pilot. And they said, how will you make it? And I said, I'll ask somebody. But all of it reflects a lot of the period, I think, in that they had that kind of confidence to let you go off and make it. And they also, I think nowadays, most places in that kind of position are committees, and you get committee decisions. Now, when you get one person, because with Mr. Ben, I wrote them, I did the drawings, and Ian helped me on the artwork and for everything else, then I didn't storyboard them, which is ridiculous. 15-minute film without a storyboard, and I wrote filming directions. Yeah. But to do it that way was just unreal. But I didn't have any idea about film. It was, but because it was done in that way, it was my voice which was very strong in the films. And when you have a committee decisions, like most committee decisions, you wipe out that single voice. Yeah. You take out. If you take out all the flaws, you take out a lot of good stuff without meaning to, I think. Sometimes the flaws are probably necessary. Mm. You know, it's like when they take out, you know, when you're playing guitar and you hear the slide on the strings, but that it's really the notes you want, but that is okay, in fact. It's part of, it becomes part of the music.
Yeah. Well, even with the pilot, watching it again now, although some of the animation is quite simple, there are a few shots that are actually very sophisticated. There's this one shot where you have the characters in the foreground and the background is out of focus. Therefore, the distance between the different plates must have actually been quite considerable in order to do that in camera.
Yeah, we did do some multiplane. Yeah, that's right. Well, we had... it was filmed by Bert Walker, who he left the BBC... And on the strength of the series, really, set up his own films, Zephyr Films.
Yeah.
He made the... he was well known for the titles of the old Grey Whistle Test of the time. In fact, Bert died about 3 weeks ago, and he, which was quite a blow, because I was always... hadn't seen him for years, and I was thinking, I must look Bert up, you know. And that sort of was hard, but a lot of the filming and things, he worked out ways to do things, a plus. The music was Duncan was already a friend of mine. We're boys who were born on the same day, went to the same nursery school. We used to see each other after the nursery school and became friends. When I was going to make the films, I said, "How do you fancy doing the music?" You know, and the music is fantastic. It's a big contribution. Bert's filming, you know, it was a big contribution, and Ray's voice was a big part of it. And Clive Juster came in towards the not at the beginning of the series, but although I think he reworked it. Probably the early films, but his editing was quite crucial to the films. You know, he was able to cut from like in the cooks. There's a scene I like where the cooks are preparing the food, and there's lots of short cuts and that to that, which works great. You know, so it was, though I. It was my voice, you know. I had such good support that it would have been all right anyway, I guess, without me.
Because of the lasting success of Mr. Ben, I think a lot of people attempted to find its influence on other things. For example, when Inception came out last year, a few people suggested that might have actually been influenced by Mr. Ben, the idea of a character going into a very different kind of scenario and taking on a role within that genre. Have any kind of modern filmmakers or animators been in touch with you to say, we loved what you did in the 70s and it's been influential on our careers?
No. These days, most people, the contact with filmmakers is when they come to me regularly and ask if they can make films of Elmer. But I don't have... I live pretty isolated, in fact, you know. Just paint, draw and write, you know. That's... I'm not allowed out very often. This evening's a bit special.
But I suppose one thing that must be encouraging is when we arrived earlier, there was a parent with some young children bringing them to the exhibition. And it wasn't just for the parent. You could tell that the kids were already fans of Mr. Ben. Yeah. So the idea of it being repeated on satellite channels, being available on DVD and whatnot, so that young people today can watch it, must be something that's quite important to you.
Yeah. I was just speaking to a parent downstairs who say they've got five-year-olds, and they said they are absolute fans of the DVD and watch it over and over every night. They have to watch some Mr. Ben. When I first started to hear that after the DVD came out, it was a surprise, because I thought it wouldn't be enough zap bang for the present present youth, if you like. They're children, they're not even youths. And but I think it probably is old-fashioned storytelling. I think probably the pace which I wanted is not a bad pace for that age group.
Absolutely.
One of the things I found interesting making film was, if you have cold film, just the film with no sounds on it at all, it's a certain length. The moment that you add music, it shortens the length. And when you add the voice and the effects, each time you're shortening the length of the film. It's as if you're giving the brain more to cope with, and so it seems to go on faster. And I think you can, you know, I've said to other people, I walked out of Ratatouille, the film, the animation film, because there was fabulous work going on, and I was so frustrated that I couldn't watch it. They were changing viewpoints and zapping from scene to scene, and there was just stuff I just wanted to taste.
Yeah.
So I couldn't actually taste it. And I think a pace of a film has got to let you taste what's there. And perhaps that's part of what works with Mr. Ben, because I've asked myself why as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, long may it continue its success. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
For more information about books by David McKee, please visit www.randomhouse.co.uk/authors/David-McKee. The illustration cupboard on Berry Street in London still has a selection of original art by the illustrator in its permanent collection, and its next temporary exhibition begins on February the 2nd, a collection of illustration artwork in support of the St. Mary Magdalene Centre for Refugees and Asylum Seekers. Work in the exhibition includes illustrations by Shirley Hughes, Chris Riddle and Axel Scheffler. For more information, visit their website www.illustrationcupboard.com or go to the gallery at 22 Berry Street, London, SW1Y6AL. Next, here's my interview with Dave McKean about his illustrations for Richard Dawkins' science book for children, The Magic of Reality.
A lot of people who have seen science books, lots of people have seen Richard Dawkins' books, would probably be surprised by this project, where there's an illustration by you on every single page. In some cases, the text is within a full-page illustration.
Yes.
This is kind of an unusual approach to a science book, because even when you get a fully illustrated science book, it will normally just be photographs or very technical drawings. How did the project first come about?
Well, I'm quite a fan of Richard's books anyway. Mm. And I read in several interviews he would get asked the last question, what are you going to do next? And many times he said, I'd love to do a book for children.
Mm.
And it didn't seem to be appearing. And I read that three or four times and thought, oh, I want to do that book. So I got circuitously managed to find who to approach to get my name on the table.
Mm.
And finally went off to see Richard. To talk about it. It seems that they had a couple of attempts at doing children's books in the past and didn't get very far with those. And we talked about it, but there was one structure for a book, or one idea for a book, that really stood out to me to be the one, for a couple of reasons. It's structured as 12 questions about the world, and then each one of those questions is answered in the way that humans have answered them in the past, with folk stories, traditional stories, theological stories, and then that's the first part, and then the second part is our very best scientific answer to that question. I really like that structure because it's a lovely storytelling style answer to the problem of talking about the real world and introducing science to children. I also kind of liked it because it gave me some really interesting myths and folk stories to draw, and then also this challenge of trying to make the science chapters even more awe-inspiring and extraordinary, because the stories about, real stories about the real world and how the real world works, the mechanisms in the real world, are extraordinary. And I'm a big science fan. If I had my childhood to run again, I think I would love to have gone down the science route.
So in a way, it's one of those vicarious things. That you're making a book for the person that you were when you were a child.
I'm doing exactly that. In doing the book, I literally went back to school. I went back to my children's school, and the physics teacher there and the chemistry mistress helped me with some of the doing the experiment and cruises and things. I had a great time. I enjoyed it far more than I ever did as a child. Mm. So, yes, I would love to do that. You're asking about the look of the book and why it's...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, obviously, partly that's what I do, the illustrations and storytelling with illustrations. But really, it was to try and get across... Illustration can do many things. it can be diagrammatic and explanatory, and you often find that in a science book. Mm. But it can do so many other things as well. Illustrations can be funny, they can be atmospheric, they can create a mood, and they can tingle the imagination. Mm. And I really wanted to try and make sure that the science sections have their explanatory moments, but they also have all these other things as well, to make sure that when you're flicking through the book, a young reader doesn't look at all the myths and go, wow, they're kangaroo men and giant fish, and then we get to the science and it's all rather dogmatic and diagrammatic. I wanted it to have that sense of wonder as well.
And I guess as an illustrator, it gave you such a wide range of things you could illustrate, from a picture of Quetzalcoatl,
yes,
Aztec god, to the formation of the universe, which, yes, must be an absolute dream job.
It was fantastic. I'm on Twitter, and I ended up saying, today I drew a giant catfish and Richard Feynman, and every day was like that. Every day was a wonderful new challenge. It was great fun, actually.
And I guess the objects in the book, things like broccoli and quartz crystals, for everything except, I guess, pictures of planets, were you able to find those objects and photograph them yourself?
Yes. I visited the Natural History Museum for a lot of material. And then broccoli's Tesco's. Well, Waitrose, I think. Mostly very simple. We had to use a couple of stock photographs. I think there's about five or six references to them in the back. Mostly because, if you say in the text, this is a photograph of the known universe through the Hubble telescope, you've got to print that photograph. I can't do an illustration of that. But for everything else, really, I wanted to try and create those images myself.
Mm. The way that your style has evolved over the years, looking at your most recent work, this book, and the book you did just before this, Celluloid, the way that you depict the human figure seems to have evolved, as I suppose would be natural, over the years. And now there seems to be an influence of surrealism slipping in. Would that be an appropriate thing to say?
Expressionism, I would say, more than anything. I started doing lots of different things, collage and all sorts of things.
Mm.
But in drawing the human figure, when I started doing a lot of comic books, it seemed to me that the human figure, which is such an extraordinary thing, an expressive thing, an endlessly changing thing, facial expressive, had been reduced down to this rather awful template of what a human figure was. And that's really because comics began at the turn of the last century, and the people that were drawing then, Winsor McCay and Lionel Feininger, they looked at human beings, they looked at real people, they looked at light and shadow, and they interpreted them in their style. But the next generation just looked at their work, and then the following generation just looked at their work. So you get a sort of slow degeneration of new information coming in, to the point where it really got rather lazy. Any person in a comic who was thinking just went like that, and anybody who was angry went like that. And you get these rather stock cartoons. And I just wanted to clear the decks again, say, hang on, remember what real people look like. So the first couple of comics I did were photorealistic almost. Mm. Just to do that, really. I never intended to carry on doing that. It's a bit of a cul-de-sac, really. But it was a way of just wiping the slate clean and saying, right, I'm going back to square one. Let's start looking at people again. And then slowly with the other books that I've done, like Cages, that taught me a lot, and my travel books, which taught me a lot, and now this book and the other things, I've just tried to find... Now that I've established my pool of knowledge, I suppose, observation, I don't want to stop observing, but you have an experience of that. Mm. I just want to start finding what drawing can bring to it, not photography, not trying to be photoreal, but drawing can really express not only what the person looks like, but how they feel, what they're thinking, much more beautifully than maybe a photograph can.
Mm.
So that's what I want to explore as somebody who draws pictures.
Because you are well known for your photo collages, and it's funny hearing someone who's been working in illustration for 25, 30 years to now to be talking about still working on drawing the human figure. I guess in a way that's something that you never perfect unless you're Leonardo da Vinci.
No, it's an old cliche. You never do perfect it, but that's the wonderful thing about it. Mm. It's an endless challenge. Much like the challenges in science, there is always that next barrier to cross, that next question to answer, and in just trying to understand things, like the human form, the way people move, the way they gesture, the way they talk, let alone what they're thinking and all, and the complexity of the way the brain works. It's a wonderful challenge.
Mm. Do you still use models? I mean, there's a two-page spread that I came across in this book where there's a boy running across a page. Was that a neighbour's friend or...?
It was probably my son. Okay. I think it was my son. I'm not quite sure which one you mean, but yeah. I think it was probably my son. I still do. For that reason, I don't ever want to feel that I know everything and that I can just stop looking and just keep on recycling my whatever knowledge is in there. I want to keep on adding to it. Mm. But I'm trying now not to let the photograph dominate the image. The photograph gives you something that you didn't know. The way somebody looks, glances, the way light falls on something. These little things, and they're beautiful and real. There's a genuine quality to them when you capture those things. But then if you can express them in a drawing some way rather than just slavishly reproduce them from a photograph, I think that's what I'm after.
Mm. Although it's obviously a very different thing to have to illustrate a boy running across a page in a science book to say finding reference to drawing Batman and the Joker in Arkham Asylum.
A little different. yes, and but then, you know, my books have really mostly been about real people.
Mm.
And sometimes the ideas in those stories are expressed in sort of rather fantastical terms, but the story is really just about real people. I'm interested in people. I'm not really interested in goblins and superheroes, really.
Well, your first graphic novel that you did with Neil, Violent Cases, that was a partially autobiographical story based on his own experiences.
It was, and it's a very old book, and I don't really look at it anymore, but the one thing I'm really proud of with that book is on the back it says general fiction. We planted our flag, really. You know, we're interested in, you know, stories about the real world and real people.
When you did that book, had you already had some paid work as an illustrator, or were you still toying with the idea, will I make a career in comics, will I make a career in illustration, or did you always want to do both?
I had no idea, really. I went to art school and argued with everybody there, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I loved comics, I loved storytelling, and I love illustration used on, you know, record covers or book covers and things like that. So obviously I vaguely thought I would love to do that. Couldn't understand why anybody would ever ask me to do it professionally. I happened to, I went to a, you know, not special art school at all, but I had some really great teachers there, and a couple of them were running design studios and gave me work, professional work. So I was working when I was a student, and I met Neil at the end of my time at art school, and we fell quickly into doing work, doing Violent Cases, and I did a few other short comics and things. So we lucked out, really, with our timing. 1986, which is when I left art school, the perfect time to get into doing comics then, because the doors were wide open, the publishers didn't have a clue what was going on, the lunatics were in charge of the asylum, and we gladly, after Alan Moore and some of the other, the sort of generation 2 years before us had pushed the door in, Neil and I gladly walked in, and others as well.
And you've done quite a few children's books now, several with Neil, things like The Day I Swapped My Dad for Two Goldfish, a couple of books with David Almond, and now this book with Richard Dawkins. It's kind of a weird way to become a children's illustrator, starting off in comics. It doesn't seem to be a route that many kids illustrators take.
Maybe not.
But one that's worked out well for you.
It's worked out well for me. I mean, I think comics as a medium is extraordinarily powerful and works for anybody, whether you're a child or adult or anybody. I started doing children's books really because I had children. And I, you know, most of the stories that I've written really are just about me and my friends, really. And the place where I live is very important to me, so the stories are my stories are often set locally. And so when I had children, it was such a huge part of my life. It was bound to get into my work somehow. So Neil also has children. It was kind of inevitable that we'd start to do something for kids, and they turned into some children's books. And having done a few, I then met David Almond, and they're very different again. You know, I've almost a lifetime collaborating with Neil. But David's books come from a very different place. Often strange and inexplicable things happen in his books. But he writes from a really deep inside the psyche of the child. There's often the child at the centre of the story. And I was really moved by those stories when I first read them. The Savage, I thought, was extraordinary. Mm. So, really happy to do those books. And they don't seem to be just read by children, you know. They're for anybody, really. Maybe the little kids' books like Crazy Hair are really just for kids. but The Savage, I've had all sorts of people read that book.
Mm.
In fact, it was chosen to be... There's a scheme in Liverpool called Liverpool Reads, where they try and get everybody in the city to read one book, which is such a great thing. And it's done with the fire department, of all places. And that kind of makes a certain kind of sense, because the fire department...
Not in sort of Fahrenheit.
No, it's not quite that, although it's an interesting connotation. Now, the fire department in a town like Manchester is seen as a safe place, where maybe a police station to some people wouldn't be.
Okay, yeah.
So the fire, bizarrely, Manchester was full of firemen asking to read this book to people in the street. It was fantastic. So, yeah, good fun.
And I guess, as a professional illustrator, to a certain extent, you can choose the projects you do, indeed writing some of the projects yourself. And I guess it's important to vary them as much as you can just to keep it fresh. Because, for example, before this book, your most recent project, Celluloid, was an erotic, silent, book-length graphic novel, which couldn't be more different.
Not much more different. Yes. Well, yes, I'm just impatient, really. I like to jump around between different things.
And Celluloid in particular seems to come from your interest in filmmaking as well. It seems explicitly, no pun intended, linked to the short film that you made in Venice a few years ago.
Yep, definitely. Yes, I mean, it's an old cliche that you end up just telling the same story over and over again. And my stories all tend to be about somebody who's slightly lost, arriving in a evocative location.
Mm.
And... determined to try and work out their problem, and the solution turns out to be something entirely different. That is my experience of life, and I've tended to keep on coming back to that idea for a story.
Mm.
Yes, Celluloid hung around in my sketchbooks for a long time. I didn't really know whether I wanted to do it. It's rather, it's kind of taking your clothes off in public to do a book like that. And I thought I might do it anonymously. I thought I might do it as like a secret book that would never be for sale in a shop or anything like that, but you had to know the website and you had to have a password, this sort of secret knowledge. Mm. And we'd print maybe 200 copies or something like that. But I got a nice offer from Delcor in France, wonderful publisher, and they did a lovely job, and I was very happy with it in the end. But it's a strange one.
Mm.
Not for everybody, I think.
Indeed. Cool. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Next, here's an extract from his presentation of The Magic of Reality at its launch in Foyles, in which Dave McKean talks about his technique.
Not a lot of science images in my portfolio, but the project that I thought pitched me closest to be able to do this book with Richard is my previous book, which was done with Heston, Mad Specs, Blumenthal, which was absolutely wonderful to do. I spent a year with him eating his food. He is somebody totally and completely engaged with everything in the world. You can see he makes these huge lateral jumps in his thinking because he's just interested in everything, and everything in his life ends up on the plate at the end of the day. He wanted the book to have a picture book Alice in Wonderland feel to it, but it had to deal with the science side of what he does. That's what goes on inside Heston's brain, if you ever were interested in that. And magic. He employs magicians. He often has little magic tricks going on in the restaurant and uses magicians' tricks to add yet another sensation to the experience in the place. Another thing that came up was trying to find visual equivalents for quite abstract things, for tastes. A cookbook is an odd thing to do. You can't taste the food. You can't smell the food. You're left with a picture in a book of the food. So we tried to find a way of filling in the sense gap by trying to find visual equivalents for some of the flavours and textures that you get eating. This is a chocolate dish with crackles and striations and mushy bits, and managed to get some comics in there as well. And all sorts of other illustrations. This is actually for hot and cold tea, and if anything deserved really to be in the what is a miracle section of this book, this is it. It comes in a little container, and it's hot and cold tea vertically. No divider. The liquid on the left is cold, the liquid on the right is hot, and you drink it in the left hand side. How do you do that? That's mad. So, I got in touch with my agent to see who on earth we should approach to see if I could get my name on the table. Absolutely no reason why Richard Dawkins should know my work at all. And when you start to talk about things in interviews as being your next project or something, actually, usually it's quite a long way away, quite a long way down the road. I thought I'd missed the boat. But it turned out that we had to approach his agent, a wonderful chap called John Brockman, John the Cat in the Hat Brockman, who runs a fabulous website called The Edge, which I highly recommend, a pool of great current thinking, and is the agent of all the great science writers around at the moment. But he started as a gallerist. He knew Andy Warhol. He knew the Velvet Underground. And I'd done quite a lot of projects with John Cale, so we had a lot to talk about. God, I'm like a house on fire. So my name was passed forward. Finally got to go to Oxford to talk to Richard about the book. 12 questions about the world, and each question answered initially in the way that humans have answered that question in the past, with theological stories, or folk stories, traditional stories passed on through the generations. And then the meat of the book, our very best scientific explanation to answer that question. I really loved this because I thought it was a wonderful storytelling solution to the science section. I also loved the idea of being able to illustrate some of these creation stories. I've written a lot of creation stories. I wrote them in my novel that I wrote and illustrated called Cages, and various creation stories in Pictures of the Tick. Cages features everybody's individual god floating above them, basically their conscience, and retelling of stories like the Tower of Babel. And all of my creation stories tend to be just about people and their relationships and just trying to deal with life and trying to understand the world. I wrote a little film, my first film, called The Week Before, which is basically God creating the universe. But it's the week before the week he was going to create the universe. So it's the week when he shows up on Monday morning and can't really think of anything to do and goes fishing instead and generally prevaricates. All the things you do to put off actually doing the work. So it's a creation myth about creation, really. Staring at a blank piece of paper. So I love that idea. Richard wrote a sample chapter, What is a Rainbow? And I did some sketches for that, and we took it out to publishers, John Brockman took it out to publishers to see who'd be interested. Seemed to go down very well. Good response to that. And looking back, I got these sketches out again to do this talk. Some of them very close to what I ended up with the final book. Some of the ideas, especially in the science chapters, heavily refined through the process of making sure that they're scientifically accurate. So my rather fanciful, brightly coloured rainbow drops went. But then we did end up with what I hope is quite a clear representation of how light refracted through the raindrop and back to the iris in your eye. And some ideas disappeared completely. Then we got to the next stage, which was actually doing the book. We started with the chapter, What is an Earthquake? And got off to a rather strange start, because I just went about it my usual way. I tried to find images that were engaging, funny, surprising, something like that. A more poetic approach, I suppose. I handed it in, silence. And I finally got to talk to Richard about it. And he really was hoping that in the science sections there would be more of a diagrammatic approach to the pictures, perfectly reasonable. This became the big balancing act in the book. What I really didn't want was for a young reader to pick up the book, flick through the myths, go, wow, kangaroo men, big fish, and then get to the science section and it's just diagrams and really didn't want that. So long as we could strike a balance between excitement in the of the pictures in the science section, colour, engaging images, and also have some of them be diagrammatic, I think that's the balance we tried to strike. Earthquakes were what happened when the giant sneezed. At least that is what they were supposed to believe, though I rather doubt they really did. Nowadays, we know what earthquakes really are, and it's time to put away the myths and look at the truth. For the science sections, I'm not a scientist, pretty obvious. So I went back to school, basically. Literally, I went to my children's school, Cranbrook School, really, and I got in touch with the physics master there and the chemistry mistress, who were fantastically excited by this. And we had a great time recreating experimental crucis and getting the prisms out and refracting light. And I enjoyed it far more as an adult than I ever did as a child. and trying to explain the periodic table and getting the, you know, working out how the shells work and fantastic stuff. The great thing about working with somebody like Richard is when we're trying to work out the exact path of Cassini as it doglegs around Jupiter on its way to Saturn, he will say, "My best friend Karen Porco set up that mission. Here's her email address. Drop her a line. She'd love to talk to you about Cassini. Fantastic." And trying to work out exactly how the human immune system works when an inconsiderate passenger on a plane here sneezes and it goes down the air conditioning system and lands just in front of my son, who posts my picture. He ingests the little virus. Exactly what that story is of how our immune system attacks it. Very complicated to work that out clearly. He can say, "My neighbour is the world-renowned immunologist, Alan Townsend. Let's get him over for coffee. Fantastic!" So, really wonderful. That's the book. I hope you enjoy it. I hope if you have children, they enjoy it and get a lot out of it. I got a lot out of it. I learnt a huge amount. I'll leave you with one of our blurbs. Obviously, you know, a book goes out and gets lots of blurbs back. We've got lots of lovely, sensible ones from some very eminent people. But my favourite, obviously, is from Ricky Gervais, who said, "I wanted to write this book, but I'm not smart enough. Now I've read it, I am." Thank you.
You can find more info about the magic of reality at richarddawkins.net, and the book is available now in hardback from Bantam Press and as an app for the iPad. You can find more info about Dave McKean's work at www.davemckean.com. Finally, on tonight's show, I'm talking to Jim Kay, illustrator of Patrick Ness's On Monster Calls and Toby Forward's Flaxfield Quartet of novels about dragons. Jim's work on On Monster Calls is a terrific mix of lo-fi skills many kids in the UK get taught in art class, such as blowing wet ink across a page with a straw to create tendrils, and evocative prints made using etched wood and vegetables mixed with digital post-production to haunting effect.
Because there must have been so many layers that you were creating in these images in the book, did you have to digitally manipulate them later on if you'd made a mistake so that you wouldn't have to start from scratch?
We made lots of mistakes. I'd say the book itself is a fraction of what we actually did. Way too much. I had a lot of it scanned in, I think 8 gig of stuff. And this is black and white, don't forget. So 8 gig of image files in total were backed up because I was doing like scanning lots of individual pieces and then constantly move them. So some entire runs of illustrations, because they go over 4 or 5 pages sometimes, that they'd be ditched. You know, the art director would go, "Well, maybe you should try again." So I would. And rightly, you know, you need someone to sort of, you're looking at it so much that you lose that subjective eye. So he would say, "That's not working, this is working, keep going at that." So it was built up, and even some Photoshop files that I was working on had up to 200 layers in by the end. Just stacking and stacking and stacking and then removing. And it's not an ideal way of working. I much prefer working. I wanted to do the whole book as etchings, but the time was very, very limited. So you're doing anything you can at all, any tool that really hastens the process, because etching would have taken years, probably 2 years to do the whole book, I imagine. But I would love to have done it as a fully printed book, but it's just not realistic these days, you know. I would do it digitally by chucking lots and lots of layers onto a digital canvas and then physically eating away until I find the point where you say, "Right, let's stop there." And then it just encourages you to reveal less, if you know what I mean. You're gradually illuminating a room rather than sort of having a brightly lit arena and then darkening it down, you know. I prefer that. It's like the old Meserton technique where you're drawing the light effectively.
And how large is each page before it gets shrunk down to the size that the book is?
Some of the drawings are A2, so okay. Looking at you know, a couple of feet wide. Some of them are bigger. I did some charcoal ones that weren't used. I did a landscape of charcoal buildings, which were, you know, A1, which I photographed and then played around with. But Very varied. The monoprints, there's some monoprints that are literally the size of your thumb, you know, tiny little creature, a little toad in there. I actually found, I don't know why, there's a toad that appears in one of the illustrations. Mm. Nothing to do with the story. And I found out 30 versions of that toad. I seem to obsess over... I'd redraw it. So, yeah, anything that goes with it. And plus, I printed from a lot of things. Breadboards were a particular favourite. If you get hold of a really old breadboard and ink it up and run it through a press, you get this fantastic, almost like an instant sort of landscape sometimes. Beautiful marks, you know. So, it really varied. Everything from A1 right down to sort of thumbnails, really, you know. Mm.
Well, I was going to ask about some of the drawings where it's just like... the black outlines of leaves on a white background. They look somewhat degraded. Is that because they've been printed from wood or because you've degraded that mark through Photoshop or through some sort of carbon paper process?
Oh, they're very simple. They're just monoprints. So okay. I take usually a piece of metal that's a bit tired out, so maybe an old etching plate. And again, if you roll the ink on very, very thinly and you know, plunk a piece of paper on top of that, and draw on the back, and you get this lovely feathery, like you say, degraded drawing on the reverse side. And the more you do that on the plate, the more ink is lifted off, and you also leave the ghost of your previous attempts behind on the plate. So you start to get this wonderful, even further sort of collapse of the quality of the line, which I really like. So, you know, 15, 20 drawings down the line, your plate's lost a lot of ink from previous drawings, and so you get this fantastic mess. And I like the ambiguity of that. I didn't want to describe anything too... I think some of them are too descriptive, the illustrations. I would like to have degraded them further, really, in hindsight. But, anything that throws a spanner in the works, really, because you get so tired of your own line, of your own signature, if you know what I mean, that you'll do anything to get away from it. Anything that destroys the evidence of you being the illustrator, if you know what I mean.
Well, that said, I mean, the only complaint I'd have about the book is I think your name deserved to be on the cover as well.
No, I feel I can't explain it. I feel a bit cheeky, really, because people, you know, ask you to do interviews and things, which is lovely, but Patrick did this fantastic story and all this work that Patrick did, and I've just filled in these blank bits around it. and it feels, I don't know, I feel a bit of a sort of fraud. None of this would exist without Patrick's words, you know, and extraordinary, really, really good. And I'm just grateful for the chance, really. It was an extraordinary bit of luck, I think.
Although you said that you didn't want the, for example, the depiction of the monster to be too descriptive so that it would still have an element of people's interpretation, did you look to other renditions of, say, the green man in illustrations and those kind of like elemental creatures?
A constant source was Goya's beautiful, he did a wonderful print of a giant. I think he did it about 1818, so he was getting on a bit. And it was, again, it was on I think he did an aquatint, and then he rubbed the aquatint back a bit like a mezzotint and did this just fantastic print of a giant. And there's something about that, the tranquility and the scale that was a constant sort of touchstone throughout the book, and it's partly about dropping the almost like the camera angle. The minute you lower the camera angle on a figure, it gives them this more elemental sort of presence, dynamic giant presence. So that was always in the back of my mind, really. That and the strangeness of people like Erdogan Redon's work, you know. I wanted that stillness about some of the images, you know. But we did, for the giant, we did try and make him, the more human he was, we tried to make his figure represent that. And when he became more angry and more elemental, then we tended to, he became more of a sort of monster, you know. So it was a case of, it was quite lucky that his physique morphs in the story, which as an illustrator is a huge relief, because consistency of a character is one of the hardest things to do in a book. There's nothing worse than having to do a character again and again and again in a book from different angles, because they've got to stay consistent. But I felt I got a lucky break here, because in Patrick's own words, he changes shape all the time and size. So that was a great license to experiment, you know.
And then I guess doing something like the foliage of the creature and the landscapes is something that you probably do from memory now, having worked at Kew Gardens.
The Green Man has always been something that I've been interested in. And I've done, prior to my first solo exhibition, I actually did my own little story based around the Green Man. Mm. And I've always been interested in the yew tree as well. It's a fascinating tree because it's both lethal in its cocktail of drugs in the seed and in the leaves. And yet, you know, it's also got these wonderful connections with life-giving properties, you know, and the fact that it is used as a chemotherapy drug, and the fact that it is a great food stock for birds and things in winter. I like that dichotomy that you have. But yeah, I mean, I did go out and there's quite a few where I was doing a book in Edinburgh at the time, and there's some wonderful old yews knocking around there, and I've still got my sketches from Box Hill, and Box Hill down south is famous for its ancient yews. You know, these things can easily get to sort of 1500, even 2000 years old. Yeah, I think there's one in Scotland that's between 2,000 and 3,000 years old there. So they're fantastic trees. Mm. Really, any illustrator is just an absolute treat.
Looking at the photo you have of your studio on your website, one of the main features of it are the many tubes of coloured paint that you've got organised in a kind of little shelving unit organised by colour, which seems a very sensible way of doing it. But it's funny to see, you know, a work like A Monster Calls, where it works so successfully in black and white, to think that you'd work in monochrome for one project and then have a full colour palette for another. Does that exercise a different part of your brain as an illustrator? Because they seem to be two quite different disciplines.
I completely think in, I'm afraid I think in black and white. I feel like a dog. I think of everything as like a David Lean movie. I don't know why. I just see everything monochromatically. And colour is a wonderful relief. When you get it, it's almost scary because you've got so many options. And I quite like the limitations of black and white. We did think of introducing colour into A Monster Calls at one point. We were going to put a single colour in, and it never came about. I'm not quite sure why, but and I have to be honest, the reason I've got all my tubes of paint nicely organised is because you do anything to avoid stuck work. So it might be your sock drawer that gets tidied, or it might be your paint that gets organised, but there's sometimes when you've got a slightly scary project that you're the same for A Monster Calls, I was terrified of starting on it. You sort of find all sorts of things to suddenly, nearly important things that need doing, such as organising your socks. So I'm guilty of that. You know.
Although obviously with a book like A Monster Calls, where there's so much of your artwork in the book, do you have to be less precious about finishing a single piece because you've got so much to do than, say, a single cover, which you know is the one representation of you in a publication?
Covers are nice because they're nice in one sense because they're a finite single piece that you work on, but they also, you have a huge amount of text slapped on top of it. And as it goes through marketing, they usually say, oh, we want more text, we want the type to be bigger. There's a terrible urge these days to throw everything in the book on the cover. So I don't know, for example, if you have Lord of the Rings, they'll want every character from Lord of the Rings on the cover leaping out. Because there's this bizarre belief at the moment that a cover has to stand out amongst all the others from 50 feet away. And so some people think that by making everything bigger on the cover, it'll do that. But in actual fact, you get this terrible white noise of covers leaping out at you. But interior, it's doing the whole interior book is fantastic. You know, it's a rare thing, but really, really hard work. I mean, A Monster Calls was exceptional long days in very difficult conditions. I was in a very cold flat at the time. So it was, I think I'd get up about 8 and work till usually about sometimes 2, sometimes even 4 in the morning, and it went on and on day after day just because it was a real experimental book, and with that comes a huge attrition rate. There's so many things that didn't work. That's the downside of trying a new technique for a book. I wouldn't recommend it. I'd stick to something you've tried and tested before. But But having said that, it keeps it fresh. You know, we needed that dynamism, I think. So I don't regret it, but gosh, it was hard work.
Well, although, you know, it's probably encouraging to people who did blow ink across a page at school thinking, I'll never use this technique again, that it can be used as an adult and you get paid for it.
Yeah, I mean, I did potato cuts in there as well. I even did take prints off pasta, you know, dried pasta. So, yeah, and all that stuff is not forgotten. Anything that makes a mark, really, I definitely stick to it. And it doesn't really, if I'm honest, it doesn't really change much from nursery to, you know, being a professional illustrator. It's all the same thing. You're just putting things on a blank piece of paper at the end of the day and hoping they work. So I like that. I think, in a way, a lot of artists try and get back to that innocence that you had at the beginning, where it was you weren't worried so much about the outcome. You enjoyed the process, and this was definitely that sort of book where the process was really enjoyable. And if we got a nice image out of it, gosh, you know, that was a huge boost.
Working as a children's book illustrator, do you think that's quite a different discipline to working for so-called, open inverted commas, adult books? Because something like A Monster Calls, it deals with very challenging material, a boy who's coming to terms with his mother dying of cancer. But at the same time, you can work in fantastical elements that perhaps would be frowned on if it was an adult book.
I don't know. Yeah, I think when I read the manuscript, it didn't occur to me at all that it was aimed at any particular sort of age range. And I know from experience, I mean, just from emails from Patrick's fans, that it has affected all people of all ages. And I think because it's an emotive subject and one that applies to everyone. Everyone has to deal at some point with loss. I don't know. It's funny, I don't approach these things and think, well, they're aimed at children. I just think, well, I tend to do it. It sounds a bit sort of pig-headed, but I tend to think, what would I think if I read it, or what would I think if I saw this? And because that's the only sort of standpoint I can reasonably go from. I find it, I think Patrick said the same thing, so I think he doesn't write consciously for people of a younger age. Mm. He just writes for himself, and, I think it would be unrealistic to aim it at a certain age group.
Mm. And then, obviously, with that book, you were given a fair amount of freedom in how to depict the monster. But then something like the Flaxfield Quartet, where you have to actually depict a dragon, and then that is almost its avatar in terms of it being heraldic or it being, you know, almost research material. Is that more challenging process? Or because you know it's your design for the dragon, you can use your imagination and not worry that you're kind of like setting that in stone?
Well, you really want, ultimately, you want the author to be happy. And you'd hate to do the author a disservice. So there's always that in mind, that you want it, because the author spent, you know, half his life creating this character and writing about it. So I'm desperately trying to get what the author sees in his head. And the odd thing is, I remember asking Toby how he visually imagine these things when he's writing, and yet he thinks quite differently to illustrators. He writes about it, but doesn't think of it in pictures. And when I write, everything is in sort of pictures, and I sort of get those down in words, but for Toby it's almost the opposite way around. And so you do try and ultimately get exactly what the author is trying to picture, and that's the important thing for me. I'd hate for the author to look at the book and think, gosh, I didn't imagine him like that at all, you know. I just want the author to be pleased. But at the same time, dragons are... there's a lot of them about, so it's difficult. It's very difficult because people have preconceptions of what a dragon should look like. And he was, to some degree, as you'd imagine a dragon to be from the description in the book, you know, so that was okay.
Cool. I think that'll do nicely. Thank you.
Are you sure?
Yeah, no, definitely.
I always feel I gabble on a bit when people ask me questions, but it's the life of an illustrator, you see. It's so isolated. You don't talk to people.
No, it was my pleasure. It's a shame that I was just... looking through your website before calling you, and I hadn't realised that there was an exhibition of your work on at Foyles. Otherwise, I'd have gone to see it full size rather than just reading it in the book. But
Oh, that's all right. It's prints from the book. Well, they are hoping to do sketches and things as well, because there's a mountain of monoprints and sketches and failed attempts that we've collected in doing the book. But so hopefully at a later date we'll have an exhibition that shows the sort of working process as well. But yeah, but don't worry, you know, it was only a short-lived exhibition. It's just on for about 2 weeks, I think. But yeah, but thank you so much for getting in touch. It's really nice. Again, this book, I can't tell you, it's just been bizarre, because the response has been really nice. I've never had it before, so thank you very, very much.
Oh, my pleasure. I mean, I think it's terrific.
Original artwork that Jim Kay did for illustrating Patrick Ness's and Monster Calls is on display at Foyles on Charing Cross Road in London until the 3rd of February 2012, and you can find more information about his art at www.jimkillustrator.com. Previous booklist podcasts can be found at www.panelborders.com, and click on the link marked Booklist. Previous episodes include interviews with Chynum Yeovil and Denise Mina. The booklist Clear Spot was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch. Thanks for listening.